Welcome back. In my last talk, I spoke about the varying sets of processes involved in the pre-dynastic period in the Nile Valley in Egypt. And we have to think of the pre-dynastic as, to a great extent, setting the stage for later processes towards much larger social and political systems along the Nile. The relatively sudden political and social developments in the late pre-dynastic, and they were quite sudden. It seems that events were really taking place very quickly over a period of perhaps a century or two centuries. These events culminated in the unification of Upper and Lower Egypt, these two regions along the Nile Valley, in a single state at approximately 3100 to 3000 BC. This is at least the traditional view of the process of state formation in Egypt. Now, I want to return in a little while to this issue of a single state covering all this territory, because you will note it at this point that this is a very different sort of result of processes of political centralization than had actually happened in Mesopotamia. This process has often been conceived of as the gradual cohesion of pre-dynastic agricultural communities progressively into two proto-kingdoms, if you like, those of Upper Egypt and Lower Egypt, through the 4th millennium BC. And then the subsequent conquest of the kingdom of Lower Egypt by the king of Upper Egypt. And you remember from the last time that in Upper Egypt, at least, this would have been the continuation of a gradual process of cohesion and amalgamation of smaller centers that was already in progress through the late pre-dynastic, resulting in small states at Nekin or Hierakonpolis, at Nakata, and at Abydos, Thies. From that point of view, this is not a dramatic transformation of Egyptian cultural processes in and of itself. It's a continuation of this political amalgamation. The question is exactly how this process took place. So Egyptian dynastic histories say that in approximately 3100 BC, Upper and Lower Egypt were united when King Narmer of Nekin, Hierakonpolis, defeated the army of Lower Egypt. So this is seen under these circumstances as a conquest, a military conquest of one state by another. And at this particular date, approximately 3100 BC. This date is obviously, it's not as if Egyptian scribes were writing the date 3100 BC. This date is worked out from lists of the lengths of Pharaoh's reigns through time. How long did Pharaoh A reign over Egypt, Pharaoh B, and so on? The earliest of these lists is known as the Royal Annals Stela. And it dates to about 2500 BC and talks in a relatively fragmentary way. It's somewhat difficult to interpret. But it talks about the ways in which Pharaoh's reigns had being viewed, at least, by educated people in Egypt in the middle of the 3rd millennium BC. As I said, it's hard to interpret exactly how these reigns on the Royal Annals Stela relate to one another, because this was not written for the convenience of Western historians 5,000 years later. Obviously, if archaeologists are trying to come up with a date for the unification of Upper and Lower Egypt, what we would like is an absolute date, so that we can compare these historical sources, like the royal annals Stela and other king lists of from ancient Egypt, many of which date to thousands of years later, so that we can compare those historical sources with our radiocarbon determinations. What we would like to be able to do to really pin this down is to have two independent sources of historical data, written sources and radiocarbon dates. And ideally, we could watch them agree with one another. We'd also like to have absolute dates for this event so that we can compare political processes in Egypt with those in other parts of the world. For example, Mesopotamia. But Egyptian chroniclers, logically enough, didn't think in those terms. So what we have to do is at least more or less accept the general accuracy of things like the lengths of king reigns on the royal annals Stela, for example. Even that Stela dates to 2500 BC. It's the earliest of these king lists. And so even it exists at a 600-year remove from the actual political events, if we're talking about a unification of Upper and Lower Egypt at 3100 BC. So our perceptions of the accuracy of this list involves making assumptions about record-keeping and about literacy over this period. In addition, what we have to remember, and this is always important under these circumstances, king lists themselves are political documents. Who is credited with a long and prosperous reign? Maybe longer and more prosperous than actually was the case. Who is omitted entirely as if they'd never ruled? We have lots of evidence of effacement of monuments all over the ancient world, a kind of a retrospective censorship of the reigns of particular rulers. This is evidence of the same kind of process. But when such effacement happens on monuments, it's less easy to conceal. Those are physical objects, physical monuments that archaeologists can detect. We can find, we can study. If we're thinking about the erasure of written history, the modification of written history, that's fairly easy to conceal. So archaeologists have to take the results of these king list analysis with a good deal of caution. In any case, this version of events, the unification of Upper and Lower Egypt by Narmer, by this king of Upper Egypt, through military force, may also find some support in the so-called Palette of Narmer, a flat, intricately carved stone tablet found in Nekin, Hierakonpolis, and probably a ritual version of a palette used to grind cosmetics. And actually, if you see from the front of the Palette of Narmer here, you can actually see this circular area in the center where cosmetics might have been ground. The exact point of recovery, and thus the exact date of the Palette of Narmer, are not known. It was recovered during archaeological excavations at Nekin, Hierakonpolis, the end of the 19th century. Unfortunately, the archaeologists who excavated it weren't actually keeping very good day-to-day records. And so it's not exactly clear where it came from, and it turns out to be this extraordinarily important artifact in Egyptian history. So here we have an indication of the necessity of good record keeping by archaeologists. It would have been nice to know exactly where it came from. But it probably dates, as far as we can determine, to about the period when Narmer was supposed to have ruled, about 3100 BC. The Narmer palette is one of a number of similar objects found in Upper Egypt, but it's by far the most elaborate, the most useful to archaeologists and the best known. And it may be significant, given the discovery in this site, that the translation of the place names Nekin in Egyptian and Hierakonpolis, which is its Greek translation, is City of the Hawk, because the hawk god, Horus, will be identified with the person of the ruler of Egypt, the pharaoh, for the next 2,500 years. So finding this iconic artifact concerning the origins of the Egyptian state at this place, Nekhen, Hierakonpolis, the city of the hawk, may well be significant. The imagery on the Narmer palette is difficult to interpret. It's one of the earliest examples of Egyptian hieroglyphic writing, but it's not clear whether the signs on the palette all would have had the same meaning as they did in later times, often thousands of years later, which renders their interpretation unclear. Hieroglyphics continued in use for almost 3,000 years, and they changed to some degree over that time period. There is, interestingly enough, some evidence of cultural influences from Mesopotamia, especially in the mythical creatures that seem to be lionesses with the necks of serpents, of snakes, with these intertwined necks that you can see on the front of the palette. Similar animals show up in early dynastic iconography in Mesopotamia. There'd certainly been contacts between pre-dynastic Egypt and Uruk Mesopotamia. We're not sure what the nature of those contacts were. It's not well understood. But such contacts certainly did exist. It's also possible to think, I suppose, that there was influence from Egypt toward Mesopotamia, except there's not really any other evidence of such influence. It would appear that artifacts and at least some elements of iconography were coming from Mesopotamia to Egypt. Much less is known about the development of Egyptian hieroglyphics than Mesopotamian cuneiform writing. The term hieroglyphics means sacred carvings in Greek and was given by the Greeks to the writing system as they saw it on monuments, but after its use had pretty much ended in the late first millennium BC. There are some signs scratched on early pre-dynastic pottery that may be ancestral to later hieroglyphic characters. And hieroglyphics slightly earlier than those signs found on the palette of Narmer, dating to around 3300 BC, were discovered about 20 years ago in the tomb of a pre-dynastic ruler at Abydos. You may remember this tomb, actually, from my last lecture. This was the tomb that held the 700 jars of wine. And these early hieroglyphics in this tomb seem to have been part of an inventory of tomb contents. Whether that means that that this ruler was trying to keep track of his wine cellar is really something I don't know. So here there are real contrasts with Mesopotamia, again, in the development of writing in Egypt. We don't have the long history of accounting systems, tokens, bulla, tablets, and so on, that existed along the Tigris and Euphrates rivers. We don't see this gradual elaboration of accounting systems. We have far less evidence of the involvement in these early hieroglyphics in economies in Egypt than was the case for cuneiform in Mesopotamia. It really seems that the cuneiform writing, proto-cuneiform, really developed in the context of economic activity. It seems to be less so the case in Egypt. Much of this, I will note, may be associated with preservation issues. I talked about that briefly in an earlier lecture. I noted that the practice in Mesopotamia of writing daily accounts, one's daily scripts on clay tablets, contributed significantly to our understanding of Mesopotamian cuneiform as a day-to-day writing system. In Egypt, we have no equivalent use of clay tablets. We have inscriptions in a variety of different circumstances, many on monumental architecture, so these would be public statements. We have some cases of paintings that include hieroglyphs, many associated with tombs, for example. But it's likely that the day-to-day use of hieroglyphics involved perishable materials, writing on perishable materials like papyrus, for example. Let's go back now, then, to the palette of Narmer. The palette displays Narmer, the king of Upper Egypt, with his name given in hieroglyphics on both sides. In one case, he's wearing the crown of Upper Egypt, and in the other case, the crown of Lower Egypt. And he's destroying his enemies. At the bottom, for example, of the front of the palette of Narmer, he takes the form of a bull, and he's actually crushing an enemy figure under his hooves. There are multiple signs that are probably very early hieroglyphic symbols that refer to settlements. The implications being that these were settlements that had been conquered by Narmer. On the back of the palette, there's a depiction of papyrus reeds. And these papyrus reeds are reeds that grow in marshy areas, and they're often associated with the marshes of the Nile Delta. So the context may then imply that some of Narmer's victories took place in the Nile Delta. So it's easy to see then how the palette of Narmer could be interpreted as a memorial of the conquest of Lower Egypt by this king of Upper Egypt, Narmer, which would, of course, agree with the written chronicles. But there are other possible interpretations as well. We have to note that. There are, for example, other marshy areas that might have been associated with such conquests. The area known as the Fayum, for example. I talked about the Fayum when I was speaking about the development of agriculture in Egypt. This area west of the Nile that had been a lake during the very wet period of the early mid-Holocene and was still certainly by 3100 BC an area with substantial bodies of water and marshes. So perhaps there was military activity going on in and around the Fayum. An alternative interpretation has been that the Narmer palette depicts conflicts between Nile Valley communities and Libyan populations trying to move into the Nile Valley from the desiccating lands to the west. I talked about this process during my last lecture. Again, the climate in what's now the western desert of Egypt was during the pre-dynastic period and into the dynastic period steadily drying out. It was transforming into desert again. And this was making this area less and less tenable for human habitation so that populations earlier living in the western desert to the west of the Nile had to move in, or at least attempt to move in, to areas where they had access to water. This interpretation, the interpretation that this actually memorializes conflict against Libyans, seems to be relatively less convincing. Other archaeologists see the Narmer palette as not necessarily referring to any specific historic event, but rather portraying the king as generally a potent and powerful warrior, and perhaps a hunter. And we're going to examine the idea of the pharaoh, the idea of the king in Egyptian history. So the traditional and historically centered view, the one that takes its cue, if you like, from hieroglyphic texts, sees warfare as the origin of the Egyptian state, with the merging of two earlier kingdoms into a single state, stretching along the Nile for perhaps 1,200 kilometers, 800 miles. This would have been seen as a personal victory brought about by the power, the personal physical power and force and wisdom of the ruler Narmer, and of course the positive relationships between Narmer and the gods. Such a view is closely tied to the conventional role given in later times to the person of the pharaoh as the center of the state and the representative of the forces of order and civilization. However, what I want to note here is that there are problems with this view as well. We have to be a little careful about this view, even though it does seem to be perhaps indicated in both the text and on artifacts like the Palette of Narmer. For one thing, it's unclear whether Narmer was actually connected personally with Necan Hierakonpolis, which is where the palette was found. Some other traditions have him more associated with the region around Abydos or Thies, further to the north. To some degree, to some extent, this view of Narmer's conquest of Lower Egypt and unification of the Nile Valley imputes later characteristics of the Egyptian ruler, the pharaoh, during dynastic times onto a pre-dynastic period before the Egyptian state and the ideologies that governed the Egyptian state had come into being. And it's entirely unclear whether that's a valid assumption. It also assumes a degree of centralization for both Upper and Lower Egypt in the late pre-dynastic that is not proven at this point. So this idea that the kingdom of Upper Egypt conquered the kingdom of Lower Egypt implies two kingdoms. However, there's very little evidence of any political centralization, or for that matter, significant social hierarchy in Lower Egypt at this time. Archaeologists have looked for a kingdom in late pre-dynastic Lower Egypt, and it's actually very difficult to see where that kingdom is. Buto, that settlement in the delta that I talked about, is sometimes called the capital of late pre-dynastic Lower Egypt, but it's entirely unclear what this means. There's certainly no major archaeological site associated with Buto. At least not on the scale of Necan Hierakonpolis. Buto seems to be a fairly substantial village, small town perhaps, but it's not walled. It's not, there's no evidence of a palace or temple there. This further assumes that the unification of Upper and Lower Egypt was a single event. However, alternate readings of the historical texts imply a longer and more gradual period of consolidation of the lands along the Nile in Upper Egypt, and then in Lower Egypt, lasting from perhaps 3200 to 2700 BC. In fact, it's quite likely that some of the rulers succeeding Narmer did not, in fact, rule over all of Egypt, even if those king lists, those political documents, claimed that they did. This is the sort of question that can't really be answered easily through archaeological research, because it rests upon transient relations between more or less equal political units that probably are not going to translate directly into material culture. I talked earlier about cases where archaeology and historical texts give different kinds of perspectives on one single set of events, and this may be a good example of just exactly that process taking place. The early dynastic, or archaic period, as it's sometimes known in Egypt, lasted from roughly 3100 BC to approximately 2680 BC, And this latter date is usually accepted as the beginning of the Old Kingdom. The early dynastic period in Egypt is not the same as the early dynastic period in Mesopotamia. During this period, there was a movement of the center of the Egyptian state, the capital of the Egyptian state, from Upper Egypt, probably where it existed at Abydos or Thebes, to a new capital at Memphis, on the border of Upper and Lower Egypt. And we can imagine under these circumstances that with the either sudden or gradual amalgamation of Lower Egypt into this expanding Egyptian state, that placement of the capital on the border between these two cultural areas would make a lot of political and cultural sense. There are relatively few excavated archaeological sites from this period. And most of what we know comes from royal and elite tombs, which is obviously not a satisfactory situation if we want to understand the development of the Egyptian state, and is even more marked than was the case in Mesopotamia. These tombs were, for the most part, subterranean, usually with mastabas, platforms made of mud brick or later stone on top. There were also often freestanding buildings, sometimes called funerary palaces, nearby. There was, during this period, a great deal of social differentiation in tomb types, but not as much as there would be in later periods, when the tombs of the pharaohs were completely different from those of all other people. Members of the Egyptian elite would continue to be buried under mastabas for many centuries after the end of the early dynastic period. During the first dynasty, at least, it appears that royal retainers were sometimes buried with the dead ruler, but this practice does not seem to have continued after that time, after the first dynasty. As I said, we also see it in the late pre-dynastic period at Abydos. So there's a relatively short period of time of a few centuries when this took place. And then perhaps as the Egyptian state became more established, the habit of the human sacrifice of retainers and servants and slaves along with the dead ruler died out. The Egyptian state during the early dynastic period seems to have been a somewhat precarious construct, still subject to internal upheavals. To some degree, this is not surprising. Think about the difference between Egypt and Mesopotamia. Egyptian rulers were faced with a significantly more challenging exercise in governance than were their Mesopotamian contemporaries. They were responsible for control over a multiplicity of communities and populations along more than 1,000 kilometers of river. It's actually impressive that these populations seem to have been incorporated within a general Egyptian cultural and ethnic identity as quickly as they had. Because Egypt, the Nile Valley, during the period of the Egyptian state, is not the multilingual, multi-ethnic cultural region of Mesopotamia. It's much more homogeneous. To a greater extent than in Mesopotamia, the Egyptian response to this challenge, the necessity of governance over this large area, was to ideologically and ritually identify the ruler, the pharaoh, as he, or sometimes she, would be known in later times, to identify the ruler with the state. And we will talk about the role of the pharaoh in my next lecture. Thank you very much.